So today, I thought, oh no, what will I teach? So I went upstairs, opened the book two or three times, and finally landed on a beautiful sutta that the Buddha spoke to the Venerable Mahaprajapati Gotami after she took bhikkhuni ordination. And it's quite a famous sutta. Many people have heard this sutta before or have heard a similar sutta called the Upali Sutta, but it's actually different. And this is where the Buddha's giving some very short advice, bringing out the principles of Dhamma, which you can know for sure are the teachings of the Buddha. And it's somehow deceptively simple, but it's a very good sort of yardstick to measure whether we're really practicing according to the Dhamma or not. And hopefully something that we can keep in mind, because there are only 8 points to this. So this is from the Anguttara 8, number 53. So if you do have the Sutta or the Anguttara Nikaya with you, it looks like this. Otherwise, if you'd like to follow online, you can go to Sutta Central. But either way, you don't really have to worry, because I'll be reading it out, and it's not so much a lecture as a discussion. So it's really inviting your participation. So I don't have all the answers. I can give you a little bit of my experience with some of these factors and maybe cross-reference it to another sutta or two. But the purpose of these discussions is to engage you with the Buddha's teachings in a way that's meaningful for you. So in a way that can be applied to your life, or perhaps looking at some of the things that you might not feel very clear on and that you might not feel apply. That's also up for discussion. So it's great when we can be interactive, and we can invite you to share your experience or thoughts on this. So for those who are happy and comfortable to speak, you can raise your virtual hand or even your real hand. There's only one screen of people, so I can see you. And I'll try and come to you in turn. And only your voice will be recorded, not your face. So don't worry. I am the mugshot. Okay. So once you've been doing that for a while, it doesn't really matter anymore. You lose that sense of this is me giving a talk. So, but if you're not comfortable, then you're welcome to write something in the chat, and I can read out your question or comment from there. So Matthias has again written down the sutta. It's number 8. That means there are 8 factors, and it's sutta number 53 in the Anguttara 8s. Nice to see Lovro, who's just joined. Hi. Very nice to see you. Good. So I think we'll get stuck in, and it's only a short sutta, so I'll try to read it straight through. And then what I'll do is give a few, or maybe even while I'm reading it, I'll give a few alternative translations for the main words. Because I have read some other words that I think it was Ajahn Chah Nisero's translation. And sometimes just having more than one word, more than one translation for the same concept can help to draw out its meaning. And we might relate to one more than another. It's called the Samkhita Sutta, which means in brief. So this is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaisali, in the hall with the peaked roof, in the great wood. Then Mahaprajapati Gotami approached the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, paid homage to him, stood to one side, and said to him, Bante, that means venerable, it would be good if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, heedful, ardent, and resolute. And then the Buddha replies, Gotami, those things of which you might know, these things lead, number one, to passion, not to dispassion. Number two, to bondage, not to detachment. Number three, to building up, not to dismantling. Okay, so I'm going to retranslate that one or give an alternative. So Ajahn Chah Nisero has accumulating, not to shedding. And another way of saying that is accumulating, not to abandoning. which I find a little bit easier to understand than building up and dismantling, to be honest. I think accumulating and not rather than abandoning is probably my preferred choice. Number four, to strong desires, not to fewness of desires. And Ajahn Tanissaro has self-aggrandizement, not modesty, which is a little bit different. But the Pali is actually apichato, which does mean fewness of desires or fewness of wishes. Number five, to non-contentment, not to contentment. Or you could say to discontent, not to contentment. Number six, to company, not to solitude. And the alternative here is entanglement, not seclusion. Yeah, so company or entanglement and solitude or seclusion. Number seven, to laziness, not to the arousing of energy. And number eight, to being difficult to support, not to being easy to support. And Ajahn Tanissaro has burdensome, not unburdensome. You should definitely recognize that this is not the Dhamma. This is not the discipline. This is not the teaching of the teacher. But Gotami, so now we're doing the reverse. Those things of which you might know, these things lead, number one, to dispassion and not to passion. Number two, to detachment and not to bondage. Number three, to dismantling, not to building up. Number four, to fewness of desires, not to strong desires. Number five, to contentment and not to non-contentment or discontent. Number six, to solitude, not to company, or seclusion rather than entanglement. Number eight, to the arousing of energy, not to laziness. Sorry, that was number seven. And number eight, to being easy to support, not being difficult to support. You should definitely recognize this is the Dhamma. This is the discipline. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Okay. Was that fairly clear? It's quite a short sutta, so I don't know. Would you like me to read it a second time? Or is that good? Should we start going through it bit by bit? Start going through? Yeah, got some nods. Okay. So, firstly, it's quite interesting to notice that this sutta is actually happening in a place. It's, blessed one was dwelling in Vaisali in the hall with a peaked roof in the great wood. And the previous sutta in this collection is actually given in the same place, but the blessed one is speaking to Venerable Ananda, the person who was basically his attendant for 45 years. And in that sutta, he's talking about the qualities that a bhikkhu needs to possess in order to teach bhikkhunis. So it's quite interesting that that one comes directly before a sutta where the Buddha is indeed teaching a bhikkhuni. And some of those qualities, of course, all of them are qualities that the Buddha possesses. And I won't go into that now because it will be beyond the scope of this. But he is obviously qualified to teach the bhikkhunis. And the Venerable Mahaprajapati Gotami was the Buddha's own maternal aunt. So she brought the Buddha up after the Buddha's mother passed away soon, about 7 days, I think, after the Buddha's birth. So he didn't have his own mother for very long, but he was brought up by Mahaprajapati Gotami. And she later became, apparently, and not necessarily universally agreed upon as the first bhikkhuni, or at least the bhikkhuni that traveled a very long distance on foot to ask the Buddha to ordain her, along with, I think, 500 or a large number of other Shakyan women. And so she was a pioneer and you could say the leader of the bhikkhuni sangha in those days. And obviously from this sutta, we can see that she was extremely keen on meditation and wanted to go off on her own. She realized that, you know, in order to practice deeply, it was good to have solitude and to be dwelling alone withdrawn, heedful, ardent, and resolute, and wanted a quick teaching so that that could be her kind of guideline whilst she was in solitude. And this was the teaching that she was given, which can be a wonderful guideline to all of us. So it starts off with, I think I'll go to the positive aspect, because we're saying in the first part, you know, what is not the Dhamma? So passion, not dispassion, bondage, not detachment, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the much more uplifting part of the sutta for me is to look at it in its positive aspect. I don't know how you feel about that, but I always feel it's somewhat celebratory almost to read about these beautiful qualities that uplift the heart, and that we can have some kind of intuitive sense would be the path. Maybe you've started to notice that through your own practice, that you're increasingly inclined to letting things go rather than accumulating, or contentment rather than discontent. And also knowing that, you know, one leads to suffering, one leads to happiness, right? This is what the Buddha's main concern is, that we need to practice in ways that diminish suffering and lead us to an ever more reliable and trustworthy kind of happiness, the sort of happiness that endures through the ups and downs of life. So we'll go to the positive aspects, and then I want to correlate it a little bit with another sutta, which is in the Anguttara 8, number 30, and just have a look at some of the description there. So in Anguttara 8, number 30, the Buddha's speaking to another chief disciple, the Venerable Aniruddha, who was his cousin. And there he goes through four of these eight and has another four that are particularly pertinent for the Venerable Aniruddha. So it's slightly different, but four of them are the same. And it gives a little bit more detail on what each of them mean, each of those four mean. So we'll go over to that as well. So the very first one, these things lead to dispassion and not to passion. I don't know about you, but how does that sound? Dispassion rather than passion. And the word here in Pali is viraga rather than, I think, saraga, which means with passion. So viraga is also something that happens naturally in our meditation. It's part of a process of meditation where we start to basically turn away from the things that create suffering, but not through aversion, not through negativity, but simply through realizing that these things, in a sense, no longer serve us and are keeping us entangled in suffering. So dispassion rather than passion. So if there are no questions or comments yet, oh, we have a comment. Hang on a minute. I will go to the deeper elaboration in a sec. So I'll come to you. So I have somebody sitting next to me, for those who don't know.
Hello.
And she has a comment to make. Yeah.
So how do you define passion?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Pali is raga. Mm-hmm. And raga is one of the three kind of root poisons, let's say, or I don't like the word defilement. This is the thing. So the word defilement sounds like there's something intrinsically wrong with us and inherently sinned and kind of dirty and terrible. Whereas something, I don't really know about poison either. I don't really like that either, but I think in a way it's better because it's something that sort of shouldn't be there, yeah, in a sense, right? Rather than something that makes us wrong or bad. Yeah, so somebody else is agreeing with that one. So it's basically raga, dosa, moha, right?
So is it desire?
Yeah, desire, yeah. Or in this particular case, it's a kind of a lust, I would say.
So sexual?
Yeah, probably sensual desire.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, more than anything else. Yeah. So there's nandi raga. In the Dhammacakka Sutta, the Buddha talks about nandi raga sahagata tatritatra binandani. It's like nandi is kind of delighting or delighting in things. Raga is more like lust or passion.
And that's a sexual thing, not just
usually it's a sexual thing, but it's not limited to that.
Okay.
It's not limited to that. It can be any kind of craving. So it's a kind of discontent. And I think it's informative to look at its opposite, which is kind of dispassion. So it's losing interest in a way in the world of the senses.
Mm.
So it's related to sensual desire, but it can be at any of the senses.
Mm.
The thing is, as a root poison, it's kind of usually related to lust because it's one of the deepest and most difficult to overcome.
Mm.
Yeah. Afflictive emotions sounds less judgmental. Yeah, afflictive emotions does sound less judgmental, but it's not just an emotion. It's kind of almost something that's so deeply entrenched. It's what keeps this whole process of birth and rebirth going. So it's almost like a default in the human being. It's, you know, even if we can get beyond things like lust, we still have the craving to be. So it's very subtle. The craving to be is not just an emotion. It's actually, it's born of wrong view in a sense, right? So it's something very fundamental to our existence as a human being. So in that sense, even poison wouldn't work, right? It's something so, we've basically taken rebirth because of these things. So they're part and parcel of how we're functioning until we start to, you know, undermine them and have an alternative. So maybe that's why in this particular sutta, there's a kind of a pair, you know, there is an alternative. Because most people don't know that. Most people wouldn't realize that a kind of turning away or becoming less entangled, a dispassion or a fading away of these things is actually a choice. And it's a choice that is a peaceful choice. And it's not a nothing. It's not that if there's no passion, no lust, there's nothing. There's actually this other quality of dispassion or of fading away, which is peaceful and which is beautiful. It has a quality to it. So, yeah, you said, yes, emotion is the wrong word. They go very deep. Did Suzanne have her hand raised at some point? Or I'm not sure. I'll give you a moment. Otherwise, we'll just get back into some of the Buddha's description about this. So you did. Okay, funny. I'm not seeing your actual hand. Ah, because your wall is the same color. Okay.
Oh, that's why. I was not. Okay, there it is. Okay, so yeah, about passion and dispassion, I was just today thinking about myself. And since the retreat in June I did with you and Ajahn Brahm, I kind of, you know, we took the 8 precepts and I kind of tried to follow through with them.
Not
often, but this one, I'm working on Brahmacharya right now since then. And I just was thinking about it today, how much less suffering there is in my life because of that.
Right.
And you know, it's like a, you know, this energy of lust or passion when it's just like stopped and kept inside and even used for my meditation. It's quite a interesting experience. It's like almost like there's this energy and joy, I would almost say, that I have in a way, in an inward way.
Yeah. So, this makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So, I mean, I would be very interested. I mean, you've been practicing this for a long time too, if you have like, to share something about this even more, or
yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. It's wonderful that you're seeing it fresh, you know, as a Dharma practitioner. I guess for me, celibacy did come as a result of practice, and it came quite a long time before I ordained. So I think by then I already had a sense that there was a lot more peace to be had in practice that was preferable to kind of being all emotionally charged up. And I also noticed that, you know, being embroiled in kind of relationships, especially sexuality, was exhausting. You know, there's a kind of buzz and there's a kind of stimulation there that's quite intense. And in a way, a lot of energy gets expended, and afterwards you feel kind of exhausted, right? And sometimes quite emotionally sort of flat. And that's, I think, why people then need to indulge again, because mm-hmm. afterwards you're not actually satisfied. It hasn't really fulfilled anything that you're really looking for, you know? Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm talking about loss now more than love relationships, but even, you know, with relationships, for me personally, compared to the Dhamma, they were just very agitating. And I found that so much of my energy was being spent on, I guess, being emotionally caught up with somebody else. And it just felt much cleaner, much purer, much less, what's the word, precarious, to start to move away from that. And of course, then we have much more energy available for the practice, and the mind would become clearer, you know, the energy would increase because the mindfulness would increase. So whenever mindfulness increases, there's a natural increase in energy. Whenever energy increases, you've got that energy to put into mindfulness. And mindfulness and energy combined leads to joy. It leads to an internal kind of joy. And mm-hmm. so we start to get that sort of satisfaction from within that is much more subtle, perhaps, but reliable and fulfilling than anything we can get through the senses, to the point where even sometimes when I'm meditating and getting a lot of internal happiness arising, which is sometimes very subtle but quite consistent, even eating something like a chocolate, you know, that's really tasty, that's particularly, you know, normally very delicious for me, feels too agitating mm-hmm. because it draws me back into my senses mm-hmm. and away from that more subtle mental energy of joy, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess I'm speaking more from memory because it's so long, you know. I think I've been celibate now for like since I was 25, and I'm 25 years pretty much, so it's a long time. But I've noticed it with the other senses too, that it can just take energy away from the process happening within and the subtle happiness back into the sensual world, so that it almost obscures the much more quiet and shy happiness that's starting to develop inside. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I also don't eat in the evening since June. And also that long period of, I mean, I sometimes eat at 2 or 3, I'm not so strict, yeah. like, but it's still quite a change for me. Yeah. And this whole period of not eating is such a relief. It's interesting that, you know, I did rely on food in the evening for emotional support.
Yeah.
And that just kind of went away. In the first weeks, I was feeling a little sad.
Yeah.
And lonely and stuff. But that disappeared. And now it's just more freedom. It's like and also that sense of taste, you know, that it's not that for a longer period of time it's just not available, and I'm not I don't go for it, go out to look for it, and it really strengthens meditation practice also in the evening.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things about, you know, monastic life, is that because you have so many training practices, I like to call them, or practices of restraint, trainings in restraint, it's only sometimes then that you notice, on the other hand, you know, that if you are going through a hard time, you don't have those things to resort to. You can't have an evening meal that makes you feel a bit more energetic, or, you know, you can't kind of just decide I want to go for coffee with my friend or whatever. You don't have those things at hand so much. And so it means you have to meet your emotions, and in a way, you know, there's less opportunity to run away from them, which is very helpful, because quite often those feelings of need, or, you know, the kind of inner, I don't know, hand of the mind that goes out and wants to grab onto something outside, it does settle down if you stop indulging it. It does settle down if you can just sit with those uncomfortable feelings. You know, they tend to pass, and then you don't even want that cup of coffee or chocolate cake or whatever anymore. It's just a default, it's a habit of the mind. I'm going to just come to the chat and then come to Shirley. I definitely feel like my practice was more fulfilling when I was single. Oh, married now. I hope your husband's not listening. What sort of karma do you think is necessary to develop in this lifetime to hope for no or at least emotional entanglements in the next life? What sort of karma is necessary to develop in this lifetime to hope for no emotional entanglements in the next life? Okay, well, one very nice karma that you can develop is loving kindness, because you are in a relationship. Okay, so the practice isn't saying, oh, I've got to detach because I'm attached to someone. I better detach myself. This is not what the Buddha meant at all. And I actually don't like the word detachment here, because I'm not sure what the Pali is. I think Matthias did put it in the chat at some point for me. I'll try and find it. For detachment, Saragaya, is it? No, that's with lost. Which one is it? Number bondage, not detachment, number two. So Gaia, oh, that's funny. So it is the one with lost, but here, oh no, it's number one. Bondage, not detachment. Apachayaya, no, achayaya. Yeah, I don't actually know those Pali terms, but I don't think detachment is a very helpful word, certainly not for upadana, because the literal translation of upadana means to take something up, to pick something up. And the opposite of picking up is putting something down. And I think that's very, very different from detaching or detachment as a thing, as a state. You know, something that you can pick up and put down is much more flexible. It's like you can utilize things when you need them and just put them down for a while when you don't. It's not an aversive throwing away or, you know, kind of avoiding of anything. So you're in a relationship, and there's so much potential to develop yourself in the Dhamma through a committed relationship. And for me, I would just look at how, of course, you can practice, you know, the relational aspects of the Dhamma, such as right speech, right intention, being very honest, being open, being loving and gentle in speech and supportive, encouraging, etc., giving each other some freedom, you know, forgiving. So many qualities you can develop there, but also see if you can purify the love, because the difference with romantic love and, say, the love of a teacher to a student or a disciple to a teacher is that there is some passion involved. There was a choice there, you know, to be with that person and not another person, because that person gives you something that you are looking for, or, you know, fulfills some emotional need. So there is impurity there. There is expectation there. And also when you live with a person for a long period of time, there can be some sort of despising creeps in, right? You're like, oh, I know this. Yeah, it's that again. Oh, they're doing that again. And you can start to almost see a person entirely in terms of their habits, and you lose kind of the sense of that person's humanity, right? So, I mean, I haven't been married, I haven't lived with somebody for that length of time, but I know how it can be, say, with family, you know, people that you think you know really well, but you actually also know their irritating qualities. And it's almost like they become defined by that, you know, they become reduced to that. So it's very important to keep that perspective of compassion, of loving kindness, and to see where, you know, the love is clingy, is needy, is, you know, expecting what's maybe unrealistic to expect. So I think that could be one way, you know, see if the love can become more and more pure and moving more towards friendship in time. And many couples who practice the Dhamma, and I don't know if your partner does, your husband does, or wife maybe, or maybe husband, does, but you do, and that's already something, and that can help to move the relationship in a wholesome way. Sometimes one partner naturally moves towards celibacy, and it's ideal if that can be a mutual decision. But in some cases, that means, yeah, both partners become celibate, or the person moves on and gives the other partner an opportunity to move on. I know quite a few couples like this. And sometimes the other partner finds a new relationship. So that's also possible. But yeah, don't really worry too much about that. I mean, no emotional entanglements, or some emotional entanglements are inevitable if you're going to be reborn. So unless you're actually an anagami, that's part and parcel of what we're working with. Unfortunately, he doesn't practice, but he does notice our relationship being sweeter when you practice. Beautiful, beautiful. Awesome. So I'll come to Shirley now and then to the next chat. Shirley.
Anyway, I just wondered whether you'd like to read the next thing on the chat before I speak, because it relates to the...
The last one?
Yes, it relates to the question.
Oh, thank you. Ajahn Brahm suggests in his talks to have forgiveness sessions each year when the partners forgive each other for what they've done and for what they did not do, that they should have done. I find this very powerful. Yeah, it's very lovely. And Ajahn Brahm was blessing one of my friend's marriage to a lesbian couple a long time ago in Germany. And he told them to do this, or advised them to do this. And they've been doing it ever since. And they say it works really, really well. And they've got a beautiful little family with a son and a daughter. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they've come through some difficult times together. But I think this really helps, you know, for them to see each other with fresh eyes and to start each year anew. So that's a great suggestion. So Shirley.
Yeah. I'm not sure I like the word passion and dispassion.
Yeah.
Because, and I mean, I don't know whether I'm wrong or, but I think I'm probably partly wrong and partly right. I don't know. But, you know, I'm not talking about sort of possessions and being possessive of people. But I suppose I'm talking about enthusiasm for maybe justice, service, helping, and for practice. Now that can obviously get very entangled, and it can get very it can get a bit heated, but I think a certain amount of enthusiasm, which I might sort of call passion, to be passionate about caring for doing something useful, can be wholesome. But I think one has to be very careful.
Yeah.
I think the whole word entangle, I think it's in the entanglement, which I really liked. There was one further along where it was somebody translated as entanglement, because that's where we get stuck, where we get tied. But I'd like you to say something about this sort of enthusiasm that, and I mean, I think there's a word, zeal, which I think is which is, you know, you've actually got to have some sort of oomph to do anything.
Absolutely. And that can come under energy too. I think that's extremely different from raga, because the word being translated here is raga. It's more like desire, actually. I think desire is better than passion in that sense, in the sense that you're talking about, you know, feeling passionate about something, about a cause, right? Yeah. And Ajahn Brahm has a lovely talk called Meditating Passionately, which sounds really strange. And in the beginning, he says, of course, I don't mean meditating with lust. I mean meditating with all your energy, all your passion, all your enthusiasm, right? Yeah. And the word for that in Pali is chanda, C-H-A-N-D, not my name, which means moon, but chanda with the aspiration. Well, it actually means aspiration, but it's aspirated as a word. And that is contrasted to chandaraga, which means like desire for the senses. So, or kama chanda, sorry, kama chanda. Yeah, kama chanda. Kama is like the sensual world. So it means the desire at any one of the senses. So desires for pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches. And the word chanda literally means kind of voting for it, sort of giving it your consent, saying, yeah, more of this, more of this. Bring it on with the cheesecake. Bring it on with, I don't know, even worse things like drugs or alcohol. You know, I want more, or lust, right? Whereas just chanda as a quality means a kind of aspiration, and it gives you the energy to pursue your goal. So I think that is probably the closest thing to passion, but also zeal. I mean, there's words like pagaha, which means energy or rousing energy. What's the other one? Arabati. Pagaha. Yeah, pagaha, I said. But pagaha is actually one of the qualities that's necessary when you're cultivating calm, interestingly. So there's these three qualities that you need. You need to practice samadhi, but alongside pagaha, which means rousing energy, rousing inspiration, joy, whatever, and also equanimity. So having some periods in the practice where you're not doing anything, you're just sitting back and watching the process happen. So it is an important part, and it's always important to balance these things. So Liz has raised her hand. We're only on the first one. It's amazing. I suppose we could talk about passion and dispassion or desire. And I actually probably prefer desire and fading away, or even sense desire and fading away, or turning away from the sensual world. It's a bit of a long translation, but I think that's what it's really getting at. It's talking about moving away from the kind of desire for sensuality, sensual pleasure, and turning away from that, but not away to nothing, turning towards peace, turning towards the path of peace. So Liz.
Yeah, I want to pick on what Shirley was saying, because she was saying, you know, the enthusiasm for a cause.
Yeah.
Well, me, I've been an activist since I was 13 years old, and I am 20 and a bit. And what happened is everything, in a way, was improving in societies. There was less racism and discrimination and so on and so forth. And then there was, well, just before Brexit, all these problems and demonstration with Black Lives Matter. And I was in London at the demonstration. I was a steward for the demonstration. And as I was going to meet everybody, you know, to start planning the walk, the demonstration and so on, I was sitting in the tube and I started crying. I thought, I can't believe it. I have worked for that for 40 years, 45 years, and everything is coming crumbling. And I was absolutely gutted. I mean, I did go to that demonstration, but on the way back, I stopped at Amavarati and I met Ajahn Amaro. And he saw me, he said, oh, where's the smile? And I said, oh. And I told him what had happened. And he said, oh, Liz, I'm so sorry you feel like that. And so he could see that was on the day to speak because I was in a dreadful state. But then I thought, you see, yes, being passionate about the cause, but you've got to be very careful because you have expectations about the results. And I remember that day, that was such a heavy day, such a heavy day. I mean, I really was heartbroken for months after because I could see everything that I'd worked for, not on my own, obviously, but I put so much energy, time, money, and so on towards all these causes. And you could see everything, like now, everything crumbling, all the old ghosts coming back to life. And you've got to be very, very careful. Yeah. So now I still do all these things, but I don't expect things to last. I've got the message. And one thing that this sutta reminded me of is the Four Noble Truths. And in fact, when you look at the Four Noble Truths, it's exactly what he said. Passion is going to make you suffer, like I did that day for a few weeks afterwards. And so on. Discontent is something which makes you suffer. Look at what you've got, look how you are, and so on, and come to peace with that, and so on. Ajahn Sumedho speaks a lot about the formidable to sing. Once you've got that, that's it. And I think he's right. I take that a lot as a tool to analyze things, you know. Why am I suffering? So, yeah.
Thank you.
That's my contribution.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, that's kind of heavy. And I think anyone involved in activism goes through these feelings sometimes, you know, that their efforts are just having no effect, or even worse, they're being undone. And I mean, I would consider myself in an activist role too. I'm activating for, how do you say, canvassing for, you know, the female sangha, giving ourselves an opportunity to actually exist. And then to be fed and have a place to stay and have training opportunities to hear the Dhamma, et cetera, et cetera. And I've been through many months and months and months where each and every day was an absolute struggle. And I felt completely cut off, really. I mean, not just felt, I was cut off from the Sangha. I was on my own, you know, marginalized and not hearing many supportive murmurs around me, especially not from other Sangha members. You know, that I didn't even really know any other Sangha members in this country, but certainly wasn't going to make contact because many of them have made their views clear about bhikkhunis. So I knew they weren't going to help me. I didn't really know what they might think. But I think, again, like you, for me, I realized that it's when we have a certain goal and that goal becomes more important in a sense than what we're doing and why, the intention that we're putting in. And I think, you know, it is that expectation in a sense, right? We have to process the feelings of despair and distress and all the rest. But it's so important to find joy in every little step we take without looking for the long-term result. And just to trust that whatever we're doing does have benefit, even if it's only for the people around us at that time, you know, that sense of solidarity, camaraderie, or for me, I get messages from people all over the world saying that what we're doing, even just the fact that I'm sitting here in more or less an empty monastery right now, really matters to them. It really means a lot to know that we're here, you know. And I think, yeah, one thing is that it's so important not to be too goal-oriented, but to act in the way we act for a certain cause that's values aligned out of the love for it, you know, because it's the right thing to do, and find joy in the fact that we're doing our best. But also, it isn't balanced to think that because there are now demonstrations or because there seems to be a rise in racism or whatever, that all our efforts are void. They're not. There's still a whole lot of progress in every field, you know, whether it's for women, for the Sangha, for LGBTQIA+, people to be more seen, more respected, more included in their workplace or in the Sangha also. There is progress. So I think we have to take the big picture. We have to stand back sometimes and maybe also search for success stories as well, you know, for places where there is inclusivity or there is a lot of anti-racist work happening, and just to keep that perspective. So it's a bit like, I think activist work is largely motivated by compassion. And because we're working for something that isn't yet equal, we see a lot of suffering, but also practicing mudita and actively seeking stories of success, things to rejoice in, places where there isn't a war, you know, places where people abide in harmony, and bringing that to mind as well. That can be very resourcing. Yeah, but I'm glad that you've approached it with a new attitude and that you haven't given up. That's wonderful. And whatever we do in the long run, we're never going to fix samsara, but we can certainly increase the beautiful qualities in our hearts, and that will inspire others and make others' lives a lot more, not just bearable, but a lot more happy as well. Aya Santachitta says, groups like ours are little islands of sanity. I love this idea and I trust these islands are very powerful. Yeah, because they're reinforcing, aren't they, of what we're doing and why. And they give us energy to keep going, for sure. Now, this island for me has been kind of the making of the monastery, quite frankly. So it's been an absolute joy. Building up or accumulating seems very broad. You could accumulate anything from a teapot collection to knowledge about the suttas. So is accumulation always a problem? It seems to me that the problem will be accumulating unhelpful things or the avaricious attitude with which it could be done. Yeah, great point. So this brings in one of the other factors. So we're moving away a little bit now from the desire or the passion as opposed to the dispassion or the fading away, and into the accumulating and building up. So that's the one that I prefer, or building up, yeah. That's the one where I preferred accumulating rather than abandoning or shedding. Yeah, so it's a very good question and or comment, and I think you're quite right. It's more the avaricious attitude. It's more the kind of idea of trying to grasp, trying to get more, you know, build up what we own. One of the qualities of a fully liberated person is that they don't accumulate anything, nothing at all. And actually, that might even spread to their knowledge about the suttas. They're not hanging on to that either. So there's certainly a time in our lives to, you know, practice the Dhamma, learn about the suttas, and, you know, become, basically increase our right view. But ultimately, I mean, somebody who's fully liberated is willing to let go of all of that as well, and understands that that does have to be let go of, because we do experience cognitive decline, whether it's just the, you know, loss of memory that comes with old age, or, you know, diseases like dementia, Alzheimer's, that actually cause really fast cognitive decline, or let's say, because we live longer, it comes towards, you know, the end of a very long life for many people these days. Eventually we're going to have to let go of things. So I think really this is pointing toward trying to encourage us to have an attitude of letting go, not grasping, even now, you know, before the time comes that we have to let things go. But yeah, these are very broad principles, and I think that's in part the point of this sutta. But I think it's up to us to start to investigate, you know, where the suffering is, you know, what are the things that we try to accumulate that do create suffering. I mean, many monastics would probably testify that teapot collection creates a lot of happiness. I went to Empty Cloud Monastery, and I don't think they'd mind me saying this because it's public knowledge, but they have a whole room set aside for tea, and it has like beautiful tatami mats on the floor and all these collections of teapots and very beautiful oolong tea. But I don't know, it might create suffering if they don't get the best oolong tea sent to them, or if the quality is not quite what they expected. So, you know, there's a line with everything, but some kind of collections like teapots are quite benign, but it's more that attitude of needing more all the time, you know. Again, one of the translations, or maybe it's another one, I think it might be the same one actually, fewness of wishes rather than I mean, that's also the opposite sometimes of contentment, you know, fewness of wishes, or sorry, it is contentment. It's the opposite of discontent. So just being happy no matter what, I think, is what the Buddha's trying to point to, and not depending on these external things as a sort of crutch. I don't know if that really helps. Gosh, I always overestimate how much we can actually look at in these sessions. But let me just see if that's one that's in the other sutta. So that was 8, number 30, I think. Well, I'm losing all my pages now. Yeah, so there's one here that's very similar, and it's in Anguttara 8, number 30. And here the Buddha's saying this Dhamma is for one of few desires, not for one with strong desires. So, and then he explains that when a bhikkhu has few desires, he does not even desire, let people know me, to be one with few desires. When they're content, a monk or a nun or any other practitioner who's serious about the Dhamma, when a person is content, let them not even desire, let one know me to be one who's content. So they don't even want to kind of build up the image of themselves, a good image of themselves. They're content with however people think about them. And he goes into contentment even further. He says, a person is content with any kind of robes, arms, food, lodgings, medicines, or provisions for the sick. I'm sure there's more than that as well about contentment. Yeah, there's some really nice parts here where the Buddha's actually saying that when we're contented, our rag robe or our secondhand clothing will seem to us as a chest full of variously colored garments. It will seem to us just as the chest full of variously colored garments would seem to a householder, and it will serve for our delight, relief, and ease. So we start to become appreciative of whatever we do have, and even the most basic item, you know, even if it's something that others would regard as a rag, seems to us very beautiful. So in this way, you know, when we can have a very a perception of gratitude and contentment, we actually don't need as much because we're so satisfied just with a simple rag robe or a simple, you know, secondhand pair of shoes. So it's very much about training our perception, I would say. Anything else about contentment? Because this is quite a nice topic. Or accumulation. I think they're very closely related. Fewness of desires. Okay, so we have a comment here. Sometimes I struggle with the idea of wanting to accumulate more, and especially clothes. Yesterday, for the first time, I tried to tackle this with mudita, being grateful for what one has. I experimented with actively generating joy for people who might have all these things. Okay, and what surprised me is this feeling of wanting more subsided. Yay, that's fantastic. So you could satisfy your wish for wanting more by rejoicing in the fact that other people have more, which is wonderful. And Ajahn Brahm often calls mudita the practice of free happiness. You can look at, you know, the world and people who maybe have something you want or seem to be very happy or successful in something that you might have liked, and feel happy for them. And then, you know, you're living vicariously through them in a sense. So it can be just as good as feeling that happiness for yourself, and in a way more noble, isn't it? It's more generous. Mudita is also the opposite of stinginess, mean-heartedness, wanting something for me, being jealous of what someone else has. So it's a beautiful, open-hearted quality. That's great. It's amazing, isn't it, that, you know, even with that practice for the first time, because you had some wisdom there, you know, wisdom to know, okay, I could try and approach this from the perspective of mudita, and then it actually worked. And you notice that the feeling of wanting subsided. Amazing. So, yeah, it won't always work. If we think, oh, now I'll do it so that the feeling of wanting subsides, that's a bit different. But sometimes we are surprised when we have no expectation. It's genuine mudita. Yeah. Anything else from anyone who hasn't contributed yet? Or I will come to Liz. Yeah. Okay. Liz.
I will be very quick, but one solution for that works for me every time. I look like I've got old pyjamas, old everything. And I look and I think, somebody's made that for me. It's beautiful. This cotton has been grown in a field that absorbs the light of the sun. And I think, oh, I can't check it. No, I keep it. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And you feel grateful just to have. I mean, I've got pyjamas. I really will have to change them because I've got holes in the elbows and the socks, which keep pitching down in my shoes and so on. But I look at them and I say, there are insects who've contributed to make this cotton crow. There are people who've picked it, people, and so on and so forth. And you think, oh, I can't change that. And that, I think, is, you know, one way you feel this connection with the whole world.
Yeah.
And you feel grateful to have this pyjama top with holes in the elbow, because you think, wow, you think about the story of this pyjama top, you know. And that also opens your heart to all these people and insects and wind and rain and so on and so forth. Mm.
Yeah. Thank you. That's beautiful. Yeah. I was just, sorry, getting distracted because it seems my computer's not charging, but I think we'll be okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, gratitude is another beautiful way of developing contentment, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the only one which works.
Yeah.
You know, I look and I think, wow, how lucky. I've got oxygen to breathe. The plants have made that for me. Wow. You know, so everything is a blessing, really.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, you know, we can actually look at these things as beautiful, but even if we can't see them as beautiful, during Corona, it was so easy because it was like, I have somewhere to live. Okay, it might not be a big monastery or whatever. It doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that I actually have somewhere to live, something to wear, something to eat, you know, just reflecting on all the people that don't have that. And rather than feeling guilty, just feeling grateful and using that privilege, because it is a privilege, you know, to be able to have food kind of even delivered to our homes. You know, how can we make use of that to help others? How can we, you know, really appreciate all the blessings that we have and then share something with others? Maybe we can't share the same thing. I mean, as a nun, I can't share food as much as I'd love to cook for people. And I'm quite a good cook, or was. but you know, I can share something else. I can share the energies of my life. I can share my love for the Dhamma. I can share my inspiration, or even just my time, just an ear to listen to someone who maybe needs someone to hear them. So there's many, many things we can share, and it doesn't have to be quantified, you know, or judged or evaluated in any way. So more chats in the comments related to this. A while ago, I made a resolution not to buy any new clothes for a year. Charity shops were allowable. One day I saw a dress in a shop window and my eyes were drawn to it. Then I remembered my resolution not to buy anything new and felt a great sense of relief. Yeah, great. In a way, that's like having an experience of being a monastic, because, you know, as monastics, we always walk through these like airports and you've got to walk through all these horrible, smelly, duty-free shops, and it's pretty grim. And it's so interesting because, you know, when you are a lay person, you can still look and you there still might be something, right, that you can buy, even if you don't really want to, but there still might be. So you're not entirely restrained. But when you actually can't, you don't even look because there's absolutely no point. And it's almost like having permission not to look. It's such a relief. Yeah, I totally relate to that. So you gave yourself the same experience there in a way. I actually used to only have clothes from charity shops and things that other travellers gave me, like their sweaty T-shirts and stuff, but less sweaty than my T-shirts. Oh, dear. All right. Recently, I realised how much it helps with Anapana to feel gratefulness for each breath. Any of them could be my last. Yeah, that's really good too. I mean, contentment with a breath, right? Can we be grateful, but also content and have few desires? You know, this one breath is good enough for me. I don't need to be able to watch my breath for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour. Forget about it. You know, I'm just grateful that right now I can remember to be aware of my breath. So thank you very much for your comment. Because it's nice to just be aware of a breath. And we can be grateful to the trees and other green things for providing us with the oxygen. Yeah. So someone else has written, my dad and I are trying out a no-buy year. Yay. e.g. no unnecessary clothes, books, possessions. Looking forward to sharing these practices with him, like mudita. Wonderful. Yeah. You can have mudita for each other as well. Not only mudita for people who can buy things, but mudita for each other that, oh, great, you didn't buy anything. Yeah, me too. I didn't buy anything and I actually didn't need it. And I actually feel free. And I have probably even more money that I can, I don't know, use on something else. Give it to someone who's homeless or to some other charity of your choice. Or, you know, give yourself something that is actually really meaningful. Buy a book instead of an item of clothing. You know, educate yourself in the Dhamma. Go to a retreat. So this is wonderful. Yeah. It's so lovely, isn't it, when you can do things with your parents and bring them a little bit closer to the Dhamma. Especially when they're open. When they're not open, don't even try. Just do what you do. And at some point, they might realize you're slightly easier to live with. Or, like my parents had the privilege of being here when Lovro was with me. And they could hear all the wonderful things that he said about me that they wouldn't have thought about. It's like, oh, okay. So my daughter helped you somehow. Oh, that's kind of cool. He's laughing, but it was really wonderful to have you here. And yeah, it was a lovely time. Thank you. Yes. And you're welcome back, by the way. Yes, you're welcome back. It's just that at the moment at the monastery, I have to tell the people who are coming that it's either the heating or the hot water. So bring plenty of warm clothes, because it seems that when the heating's on, there is no hot water, but there's hot water when the heating's not on. So at the moment, I'm not putting it on until about 4 PM when I finally am so cold, I need to take a shower, and then only I'm putting the heating on. But that will have to change when I have visitors. I don't know how we'll work it, but you either smelly or cold, okay? So but we can manage. We can at least get a flannel and, you know, wash ourselves somehow. But just bring lots of warm clothes, please. I'm saying this for Matthias's sake and also if Lovro's staying over during that time. So we're almost out, so I'd probably only invite maybe another comment. I also... It's a shame because I kind of wanted to look a bit more at this other sutta, but I guess the purpose of these discussions is to connect with each other more than anything and to get you interested. So if you do have time, I would recommend you read this other sutta that the Buddha addressed to the Venerable Anuruddha, not Anagarika, you can be an Anagarika if you want, Anguttara Nikaya 8, number 30. Could you just pop that in, Matthias? And it's called Anuruddha. And just see how that one relates to this one, because it's interesting. Some of the factors, as I said, are the same and some are different. And one of them is actually that this Dhamma is one for one who delights in non-proliferation, not in proliferation. And that was special for the Venerable Anuruddha. He'd already worked out the previous seven, but that was his weakness. So even great arahats, people who went on to become great arahats in the Buddha's day, had difficulties with thinking, overcoming proliferating thought. So it's very interesting. And then he says that if he follows these principles, he'll easily enter into the jhana states. And as a result of the jhanas, he'll be even more contented. And that's when he's saying your rag robe will seem just as a chest full of colored clothes would seem to a householder. And it will serve for your delight, relief, and ease, and even for entering upon Nibbana. So this is how powerful contentment can be. When you dwell contentedly, your bed and seat made of straw. And I was just talking to my friend Jiva, who's come to visit me. She's one of my oldest Dhamma friends since before I was ordained. We were just talking about how we used to sleep on tatami mats. And just basically the floor, or very, very thin kind of moldy mattresses that didn't really qualify to be called mattresses at all.
I didn't notice the mold.
I think they were quite smelly, actually. Yeah. We were so content we didn't notice the mold, the damp. Yeah. But it says here that when you dwell with contentment, your bed and seat made of straw will seem to you as a couch spread with rugs, blankets, and covers. With an excellent covering of antelope hide, with a canopy above and red bolsters at both ends, just as that seems to a householder or a householder's son, and it will serve for your delight, relief, and ease, and for entering upon Nibbana. So if you do come to Anukampa with gratitude and contentment, you'll feel as though you're in a sauna, and your cold shower will be just like... having a long soak in a warm, foamy bath. Anyway, it's just showing us the power of perception. And of course, this is after very deep meditation where we really are truly and deeply content. So I hope that this has been of some benefit. I hope that it was a little bit structured and informative as well as discursive, and that there's something for each of you to take back with you and practice, continue practicing and applying in your lives. So yeah, I will invite Manoj, who is ready to say something more, and then I will let you know our next events.
So thank you very much for this wonderful teachings and even giving homework now. And thank you all of you for being part of the project and being part of this community. And it's wonderful to see old faces and new faces as well. And as you may know, this sutta discussion and all the other Anukampa regular teachings are offered on a donation basis. And with people like you, with your generosity, Anukampa and Venerable and the future bhikkhunis, they can provide community and wide world. All these Dhamma talks, teachings, meditation retreats, all that. And so this is how Anukampa exists, solely from the community's generosity. And thank you, Matthias. So there is a donation link. When you go to the donation link, there are two methods of donations. Number one is a financial method. So there you have the normal bank transfer and the PayPal. You can select one of them. And so if you are able, you can do a standing order. And please note that, you know, any small amount, no amount is too small, and it is gratefully received. It is your generosity which counts. And then the other one is the regular shopping deliveries or shopping or supermarket vouchers are very helpful because now that Venerable Chanda is there, and it, as you can see, the visitors are, you know, going to come. Oh, we will fix the heating very soon. As the plumbers get there, they were not there during the Christmas, I think. And then the other one is, which is coming shortly, please look out. There is going to be an Amazon wish list coming shortly. And that will have the immediate needs for the monastery, because the guests are coming, and we need to keep people comfortable and look
give
after them.
A bed. We need to give them a bed. We need two more beds and two more mattresses and some more duvets and things like that. That's kind of not as urgent as the chairs. We need meditation cushions and chairs because we want to start having retreats here more often. And we don't have enough chairs, which means we can't get enough people in because mats take more space. Anyway, we need some meditation cushions too. So I've made a little list, and there's some other things like pans and things like that. Basically household things. So that will be in the next newsletter. I don't know if you can even search for it already online because it's a public list. But anyway, we'll figure that out. So thank you all very much. And I wanted to say something about the... can't see you, I can only see myself now. I wanted to say something about the next teachings, because tomorrow there won't be a metta meditation. I have my friend here and I'm having some Dhamma time with her. And usually there'll be two, maybe sometimes three mettas a month. And the suttas will be almost every week, but check online because some weeks we have other events, so just keep a check on the website. It'll be in the newsletter, but for last minute changes, look on the website as well. And then, of course, Bhante Sujato is coming here on the 27th to stay at the monastery. So if any of you are around at that time, you're very welcome to pop in and offer dana or, of course, attend the talks. And there's another talk now on the 31st in Oxford at the Oxford Buddha Vihara for anyone who can attend that. There's still a few places left on the day retreat on the first, but not many. Right. And we're completely full on the second. Right. So, oh yeah, there's Brighton as well. There's places there. My friend's actually from Brighton Bodhitree. So there's still a lot of places on that. That's the Metta and Chaos retreat, which sounds great. Metta and Chaos. It's like Metta towards chaos or Metta despite the chaos. Anyway, we'll find out. and that you can book on Bodhitree Brighton. Please don't ask Anukampa about that because we didn't organise it. I think there's plenty of space. Yeah, it's a day retreat.
Yeah, it's
what else? I'm sure there's things I'm missing, but in the newsletter I'll be talking about other day retreats that we're having at this monastery for anyone who can make it more regularly. I'm doing a Finland retreat, which is full, and a Norway retreat, which is still registering interest. Apparently there were 75 people registered interest for 50 places. But you can still register your interest and it'll be a matter of, you know, booking quickly when the booking link goes out. So that you can find on Buddhist Society of Norway website. Okay. I think that's all I can think of at the moment. So I better let you go. So take care, everybody, and look forward to seeing you at the next sutta. Take care. I'll be back next week. Bye. And the Metta chanting on Wednesday. Take care.